Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Money Making Mothers, where I'm joined by Amanda, who is a trauma-informed wellbeing consultant in the fitness industry. So I'm sure many people like me want to know what that is and how you get to be in that type of industry. So thank you, love, for joining me today to speak with me about this and about what you do. So can you explain, please, so we know what it is?
What is it? It's quite a new, it's not a new concept, but it's only now that people are really popping up with trauma informed in front of, you know, anything that they do. I've been a personal trainer. I've been working in the fitness industry for 12 years now. I was formerly actually the UK PT ambassador for Fitness First UK. So I used to do a lot of the media and things. I used to contribute to magazines. I did like women's fitness. I did something with GQ, Runner's World. Did a lot of, hate saying it, always did a lot of stuff with the Daily Mail. You know, as parts of it, that was mainly correction work, if I'm honest. But so I've worked in the fitness industry for a long time. But how I actually got into it was through managing my own mental health, my own trauma. So that's essentially what it is. I, rather than looking at it from a point of body perfection or body projects, even though that's something that I think that is absolutely fine for people to want, it's not a bad thing to want to be in good shape, I help people to understand what that means for them and help them to use fitness and nutrition as something that supports them rather than as a weapon.
Am I getting this right? Almost as if like using that to help, like as therapy, like to like help yourself like understand what you've been through and use it, fitness and nutrition, to guide your way back to feeling, I don't know, not better, but feeling in a better mental state.
Yeah, in a roundabout way. So it's in using it as therapy, it would be that exercise and nutrition can be therapeutic. You know, when you exercise, it's well publicized that, you know, you release endorphins and the happy hormones through exercise. But what has happened is, because of the diet industry, it's been manipulated in such a way that it takes people's pain points and uses that for return custom. So it's built this idea that, you know, if you follow this plan, this is going to fix everything. And people have come to really hook on to that. You'll notice that people sometimes say, oh, you know, I need to, that's quite common. Or I know what I need to do, but I just need to follow this plan. It's this idea that if we're unable to follow a plan, we're somehow defective. I'm helping people to understand that that is in fact not true. And that we do all know the answers. Like, people know what is like healthy, but we're a little bit confused because there's so much different information being put out there telling you, no, you should be doing this, you should be doing this, you should be doing this.
So basically going from diet to diet, like, bloody hell, I've tried every diet in the book, and my nutrition is shit, so I'm probably the perfect person to be listening to you talk about this, because my nutrition is always based on whatever somebody else is telling me to do. And if I'm not doing the way they say it should be doing, then I'm doing it wrong. So, yeah.
I think this is where it can be it can be quite triggering work. I recently did a TikTok, as you do, or on Instagram, it's Reels, isn't it? About self-sabotage, reasons why people self-sabotage their body goals. And it touches upon that. Fitness and exercise is one of the easiest ways and one of the most socially acceptable ways, alongside things like alcohol, to perpetuate self-harm. like it's like an admirable thing, isn't it? It's like, oh, I just need to be more disciplined, or you know, people cussing themselves out for their choices,
yeah,
and labeling themselves inherently good or bad dependent on whether they exercised or not, or whether they're eating the right foods, and this has become really socially acceptable, and then we as a society kind of can't see why we feel miserable and why people have like self-worth that is decreasing. Because when you hook your self-worth on whether you're eating what you perceive to be the right things or the wrong things, it ends up being a cycle. It's cyclical. And because it's something that people tend to start in their teens now, and it's getting younger and younger, the cycle is getting longer and longer. And the longer that you're believing these things and taking the same actions, the harder it is to break it, especially when, again, the media cements it in.
How bad of an impact do you think that like the media and social media has on mental health?
I could go two different ways with this. It's like anything else. Everything has two different kind of, it's like polarities, if you like. Social media, like the food and exercise practice itself, can be amazing, or it can be massively detrimental. And it depends how you use things. It's striking the balance. So this is true with everything. Literally everything in your life is about finding a balance and finding and understanding yourself, what meaning things have to you, what your identity is. So social media is very easy to get caught up in the comparison trap. It's very easy to feel like you have to show up in a certain way. It's very easy to see people's curated versions of their lives and what they're doing, but not seeing the other side of it. And being someone that is massively adept in, you know, kind of I'm like a professional people watcher, literally. Like, I study social psychology, so like I'm quite good at human behavior and the psychology of things like social media. And what you see is, if you look closely when people are coaching things, because there's a like an abundance of coaches at the moment, quite often what someone is coaching is particularly at the moment, is what they're going through at the moment, what they're trying to process. So when you see someone telling you, oh, you need to be trying to unhook from the idea that, you know, what's on social media is perfection and da-da-da-da-da, that's what they're working through themselves.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the people that are coaching, you learn better what you teach. So I've kind of went a little bit round there, but that's kind of what I mean with social media being good or bad. You get, if you get stuck in the comparison trap,
yeah, it can be
bad. It can be terrible, because you're going, oh, they've got this, they've got that, da 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 da. Or if you're looking on at coaches as being, again, perfect, if you can unhook from that and instead look at, we are all individual people trying to make sense of what we're doing.
Is there anyone who you admire in social media, or admire who is in the media, who does it well, like who's honest and, you know, get fair in terms of like giving people the information the right way?
In terms of fitness and nutrition, it's a hard one, because I think what I'm tending to look at more is the psychological aspect of it, the social and sociological and psychological aspect of it. So the people that I am really, whose work I really like, are the likes of Brené Brown, people that are teaching us lessons, but also if you actually look into her work, rather than what happens is we tend to look at memes or just like the quotes that come out. If you actually go and look into her work, she's very honest about her own struggles with you know, the very things that she's talking about. So anybody that is really open and transparent about what they're teaching, but saying the reason why I am teaching you this is because I have had my own struggles with this, and I am not teaching you from an ivory tower. Yeah. So when we go onto social media, we tend to look for the shiny pictures, the amazing things. We look at, we get used to that manifesting, right?
Yeah.
Looking at, well, we've got to look at exactly what we want. And we can't look at anything else. We can't look at, you know, anyone that's talking about the struggles of it, because then I'm inviting the struggles in. Whereas that really massively oversimplifies the process. So if you're looking for someone to look up to on social media, what you want, someone that is positive and gives you the steps, but also says, it's not as easy as this.
Yeah. I mean, you're
going to find that it's difficult.
You're very open and honest on social media. Like, I know, obviously, I originally like connected with you through LinkedIn and then on Instagram as well. But you've been very open about your own struggles, and I admire you for that, because it must take a hell of a lot of courage to open up like that. So, how did you come to think, I'm just gonna get it out. I want everyone to understand why I'm in the position I'm in and how I've got here.
I think even with me, I find particularly through the with the whole COVID struggle and everything like that, I have had to notice the difference between what is sharing beneficially and where I am over identifying with my trauma. So we feel a pressure to show up on social media consistently, right? I've had to be slightly inconsistent, because I go through periods of time where I share because I know that, say, 5 years ago, I needed someone like me to say, no, it wasn't easy. This isn't easy. I make it look easy because I've been doing this for 15 years. Yes. I'm in good shape and I'm able to get results quite quickly, but that's because I've been doing this for 15 years. But this is what I'm going through, and this is what's happening in the background. But what I have had a bit of a danger to slip into is getting addicted to my own story. So it's a fine balance to get. And I think because we're all told on social media, oh, you have to be more authentic. You have to be vulnerable. But there's, again, it's massively oversimplified. It's not telling people the nuances, the little things that you can slip into. There's people that are being vulnerable about their struggles on social media that aren't ready to do that because they haven't processed that themselves. And then they crash with it and then feel really like, oh, if I don't get the same response as someone that's got a huge social media following, it gets internalized as like a self-worth thing. And I think this is, you know, so I have to be very careful and very responsible with that, because I've been sharing about my mental health since about 2013. So I'm a little bit better at discerning what is helpful sharing, what is sharing from a good place with intention of helping people to feel less alone, and what is through the intention of me trying to get external validation because I feel sensitive, a time when I need to actually take myself away from social media and go, what do I need right now?
So how did you actually begin to get into this industry? Like, how did it all come about that you're doing what you do now?
Well, I laugh because it's kind of really random. My degree is actually in fashion design for industry.
Yeah.
So when I left school, I had that pressure. My dad had died when I was 15 from alcohol addiction. So, you know, that my story of trauma begins really quite early, and when you have parents that are addicted, you know, it's something called parentification, which is where the child is basically made to feel like they're responsible for their parents' emotions. And I didn't get the support in school that I needed. And a year after my dad dying, And my guidance teacher had shamed me for my lack of attendance in school and said, you're not going to get into university. You better start looking for jobs. I know it's been hard, what with your dad dying and all, but let's face it, it's been a year now.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'd love to say that things are different. Well, I think there is more awareness and stuff in schools. There is still, I'm still noticing that air, and we're going to have an uprising of that at the moment where people are brushing away people's experiences because we're all struggling. And this is why it's really important to develop a sense of self-awareness and get really good at our own self-care. So I did a degree that I was like, well, I got three acceptances into uni. Like, I was like, screw you, the next day. And I went and did that, but I didn't genuinely want to do that. I did fashion design because they wouldn't let me do higher physics without higher maths at school. I wanted to do sound recording engineering. So I'd already went in not really wanting to do what I was doing. And I ended up falling in love with fitness. I wanted to go to the gym more than I wanted to be in university, and I started getting really good at it. But initially, I did all the wrong things. I'd gained lots of weight because I was drinking, I was smoking, I was eating pretty much just beige, you know, early uni life. I was so unhealthy. I'd went from being really stick thin at school, really naturally skinny, and being bullied for it. People used to say that I looked like the anorexic girl in the video and things like that. So weight has always been a sensitive issue for me. And I'd gained lots of weight, and I had a boyfriend who had went, oh, usually I go out with girls that are like this, you know, holds up his fingers to say stick thin, but I'm going out with you.
Nice.
And and this is the thing, we don't realize, we say these things that we don't think are that big a deal that can just trigger someone into, you know, just completely, you know, losing themselves. And so I dropped about 2.5 stone incredibly quickly. I was just under, I think I was about somewhere between 7.5 stone and 8 stone at 5'10". Yeah, so if you see what I look like now, like, that's 2 stone lighter than I am now, and like, I'm pretty small. And I became addicted to that. I became addicted to the pain of hunger, and it was like a two-way thing, because all of a sudden my mum was concerned. My mum had developed a drinking problem, and I was in so much pain over that because I couldn't understand why she had done that after losing dad the very same way. So subconsciously I'd found, and I can understand it now, subconsciously I'd find a way. I'd been overlooked as the one, because I'd been so self-sufficient all my life, been overlooked anytime I was struggling. So I kept on creating these things that were causing pain in myself to be seen. And that's continued throughout life. It's only, you know, since I've started myself studying psychology and trauma and human behavior that I was like, oh, you know, I need to start unpicking this. So I destroyed myself. You know, I ended up, I was tiny. I was so small, actually, that I had to sleep with a duvet underneath me. Because my ribs would mold into the mattress of the bed, and it was too uncomfortable to sleep. And I lost friendships over it and everything like that, because the body dysmorphia meant that, you know, people didn't understand. I was tiny, but they didn't understand why I still was panicking about my weight. And, you know, everything was hanging on that. Now, you know, 15 years later, I've come to understand that I'm waiting for my diagnosis for autism, ADHD, OCD, and all these things are interlinked as well. So undiagnosed ADHD in particular could be linked to things like body dysmorphia and eating disorders as well, because it's just, you know, it's all a sense of not understanding yourself. And it's socially acceptable. It's socially acceptable. You can dress up disordered eating and a distorted body image, and it's like a badge of honor. So I snapped out of it. I have no idea how. I went the other end of the scale. I ended up with binge eating disorder. But this was never identified by the NHS. I went back and forth for years. And because of my propensity and ability to mask and script through being autistic, I would then go in, and instead of asking for the help I need, I'd go in saying what they would want me to, they would want to hear, and then go away being like, that's not what I wanted. Madness. So I just, that's how it came about. I ended up then being like, right, okay, nobody's listening to me. I need to fix this myself. I need to help myself. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't have made it through my 20s and stuff. But I got really good because of the place where it came from. I started finding love and like excitement and passion in fitness and looking at after my body. It went from being something that I used as a weapon to self-destruct to being a tool for my empowerment, a tool for saving my health, saving my mental health. So I ended up becoming really interested in nutrition and fitness, but down to a very biological and psychological level. So understanding the whys behind it, understanding how your body reacts to certain movements, to certain foods, and in turn to trauma.
Yeah.
So it's wild. It's absolutely wild the amount of stuff that I've learned over the years. But it's easy for it to look easy.
And how many like people, because obviously it's not something that I haven't heard of it before being used like that. I mean, it makes, when you're listening, it makes total sense. Like it blows my mind what you're saying, because it does, you think, well, why isn't this being spoke about more or being done more, you know, in gyms or for counselling? But how many people do you feel receive it well, like it works well with them, like when they actually listen, or do they just switch off because they want instant results for the wrong reasons?
So this is the difficulty. That's it. That's exactly it. So the diet industry has been built upon using people's pain points. And it's only recently has a tiny amount of regulation come in that manages this slightly. But we're still seeing social influencers in particular who are incredibly popular, make a lot of money off of the back of using fat shaming, fat phobia. It's the same as mental health. I'm seeing a lot of people, you know, making pleas to the government and things like that. And I understand the desperation, but the system and capitalism, they aren't built on genuinely wanting the best for people. They're built on how can we make the most money. Yeah. Wellness doesn't make money. Sickness makes money. If you can convince people that they are defective, if you can convince people that they need what you're selling and make it fallible, then, you know, it can create that cycle. But because it's so popular and it's so widespread, it triggers what I do. So I'm going to throw a term at you, but you'll be like, what? It's only recently that I really understood that this was what it was. It triggers in something. When I try and explain what I do, it triggers something called cognitive dissonance in people. So if you hold a belief that you are like, no, this is the way, this is it, you are wrong, it will likely trigger people to push back on it, even if it means, like, I've had a lot of people that have went to purposely upset me when I try, and they've asked me for my help. I'm not talking about me going out and saying, oh, you need yeah, this. People will come to me, and if I say, you just need time and we need to figure out and we need to unpick this, so it's incredibly emotionally laborious work, if you like, for everybody involved, because whenever you are going to dismantle any belief that is deep set in you, it's not going to be easy.
No,
we fear change because it's difficult, but change is the only constant we have. And if it was easy to change these patterns, we would have done it before. But yeah, I mean, because the work that I do is more of an investment than what people would consider for personal training or therapy or any of these things, there can be quite a kickback to it because there's a guilt element, a shame element. I've already spent so much money on what I'm doing. I don't want to invest in that in case it doesn't work. And it's not because they don't believe in what I do. It's because
not what they're used to.
It's not what they're used to. It's not... It's that fear when we have spent all these years being sold into an idea of this is it, this is what's going to fix it, and it's a lie. Of course, people aren't going to be open to trying anything different because we trust, we want to believe that things work, and sales is sales.
And change is hard, especially when you've done it for a long time. But you yeah. obviously, like, you were doing all of this, and you've been on this difficult journey, like, you've grown as well as being a single mom. So how's that been? Like, how have you managed to obviously build up this business and the way what you're trying to do with it whilst being a single mother?
Do you know what I think it is? It's like I've been, because it's not something that's brand new, it's something that I've been building over years and years and years. It's not brand new. The challenges come with the fact that I pulled myself out of London. I kind of felt like I was invincible. I pulled myself out of London when I became pregnant. So I had a single pregnancy into single motherhood. And when I was pregnant, it was when all the attacks were happening in London. And I was like, no, I am not doing this here. I'm going back home to Aberdeen. But I didn't get the support that I thought I was going to get when I came back to Aberdeen. So again, fitness and nutrition, when I was going through my most vulnerable period of time in my life, and I was emotionally and financially abused, I had to drop into that right. I've been here before. I know what to do. So what I did was I used building my business, fitness and nutrition as that way to remind myself, I am strong. I can do this. I knew that by using certain fitness and nutrition, I would be able to support my immune system, support the ability to be able to breastfeed, and support my mental health while I was sleeping 2 hours a night as a single mom. Building the business at the same time was because I was like, right, I know the benefit of exercise and nutrition and spending time with people in the same position has on mental health. So I set up this business initially as mum and baby exercise classes.
Yeah, I love
that. And then it just grew from there.
That picture of you when you're lifting away and you've got a big bump.
Yeah.
I love that. You look like you're just so empowered in that picture. I love it.
Oh, you get so many funny looks. I think, when I was still in London, when I was pregnant, it was one of those things where, because I'd been so small and it's a really, competitive environment that, there's 40 other personal trainers in central London gym. I was in gym box in Farringdon. People look at you one girl came up to me and she was like, oh, congratulations, I didn't realize you were pregnant. So they just thought I was putting on weight. But other people saw me doing things like Olympic lifts, so cleans and deadlifts while I was pregnant. And of course, the general consensus is that, you've got to be gentle with yourself during pregnancy and da 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 da. But like anything else, it depends where your starting point is from. For me, I was doing stuff that was about 40% of my capacity.
Yeah.
So where to the outside, it looked like, you shouldn't be doing that. I wasn't doing anything that would put me in, or my little girl, in danger. In fact, Ruby is insanely strong. She does like pull-ups on the windowsill and stuff like that now, and she can run fast. I'm like, what have I done? I can't take my eyes off of her, because if she takes a ball, she runs.
How's it been like being, how's that part of your life been like becoming a mother? Like, Have you found it a struggle to obviously be able to work and juggle motherhood and working?
The hardest thing has been the hit to my ego. if I put it like that. Yeah, like I've been used to being able to build businesses really quickly and to a really strong position within traumatic situations. But all of a sudden I had this little human. I had a diffusion of responsibility. And ultimately, after living a life where, I lost both of my parents to addiction and there was a lot of trauma that I experienced, my main concern is giving my daughter a different life, a different opportunity. So my ego has taken a hit because I haven't been able to just go all in on my business. So I think that's the most challenging thing in terms of becoming a mother. Like, my daughter is my greatest gift. And if you ever want to learn more about yourself and more about how to look after your own mental health or your physical health, the best people you can learn from is children, because they are not jaded. They literally tell you as it is, because you only learn boundaries and ego and things like that. Or sorry, not boundaries and ego, boundaries and set, like being able to discern what is right and wrong, like when you're a little bit older. So if you want to learn to be more self-aware, learn from your kids. The younger, the better, because they will tell you everything you need to know about how to ask for what you want.
Yeah, they do. Like, they don't all back to them. They just say it exactly like it is. Honestly, Alba, like, we... especially like we've got two boys and a little girl, and my little girl is just like the confidence and the sass she has, I just hope she never loses it. But you know that when she, that's just what happens, isn't it? They get older and they start to think that they can't say that or they can't behave like that. But it's just amazing to watch. I wish I could film every bit of it, you know, like to watch it back, because it's amazing how innocent they are, but what they're saying is right. Like 90% of the time, what they say is actually makes more sense.
And I think that's it. I think the most powerful thing as a parent, if we don't want them to lose that edge, is, you know, quite a lot of the time when you look at things that are taught, like different approaches to parenting, there's child-centered is really powerful. If you want them to retain that ability to defend themselves and stand up for themselves, as long as you empower that and cultivate that at home, they're going to be much better protected out in the world to say, I'm not letting you talk to me like that or treat me that way. It starts from home. It's built at home. There's no such thing as giving a child too much praise, or, you know, there's quite a skewed all over the place thing about what is discipline and how to do it. And I think if you learn how to speak to children like little adults, it's amazing the difference.
If you could teach Ruby anything, what would it be? Like, if you could teach it to be or to understand one thing.
That she is her own person and she owes nobody anything. I get asked quite a lot why I heal so much, and it feeds back into this. I do the hard work of healing, not only because I deserve to feel better, but because I fundamentally understand that my daughter owes me nothing. So if I don't heal myself, she has every right to walk away if she feels like I am not the safe place
for her
that she needs. So I think that's really important, is cultivating that understanding that sometimes parents are wrong. Sometimes we just have to say, do you know what, I'm sorry. And just remind that, because I think there seems to be quite an element of gaslighting. If you white lies and all these kind of things, they're not useful. Teaching herself to learn her autonomy and stand up for it, basically.
Yeah.
But it's quite a roundabout answer.
No, it makes
but but that, because I think that is the most important thing. If there's one thing that I wish I'd been taught when I was growing up, it was that everything that happened to me wasn't my fault. I didn't deserve that. So yeah, basically that.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. Honestly, like, I've my cogs in my head are going round the twist now. but if anyone wants to get any more help, like, or looking you know, what you do a little bit more, where can they find you? Where's the best place for them to get you?
So I've got the easiest email I've got is actually a Gmail one. I need to tidy up my emails, but strongmamamoves@gmail.com. But I've got my website, I've got my Instagram, LinkedIn, you know, the normal bits and people. Strong Mama Moves, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today, love. I've really enjoyed it. And I obviously I'll stay in touch with you. But yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.